Well, again, we came, you came, in order to debate the issue among the candidates actively running for president in November. Donald Trump is the best choice. Yes, no, or undecided. Here to defend that resolution, Art Laffer of the Laffer Curve. Art, please come to the stage. For the negative, the Libertarian Party candidate for president, Chase Oliver. Chase, please come to the stage. As you know, we've got a guy in front who's flashing time cards. Art, you can take the podium or you can sit. You have 15 minutes to make your case. Jane, please close the voting. Art, take it away with your argument.
I'll take the podium if I might.
Please.
I'm the same height either way. Although the microphone has to be lowered. But thank you, by the way, Gene. Gene's brother was my classmate at Stanford. I'm 84, 2 days from now, as you said. And coming here, it was sort of fun because I don't know this area of New York. I'm from Nashville. And I wandered around here a little bit ahead of time, and I found this little bookstore, really niche type of bookstore thing. And I opened the door. And there was the proprietor sitting behind his desk. And I just sort of blurted out, by any chance, do you have Donald Trump's latest book on how to get rid of illegal aliens? The guy looked at me, put down his glasses, get the hell out of here and don't come back. And I said, yeah, that's the one. Do you have it in paperback? Lou, if you use that later, I get royalties. Is that? Let me just say that it's really fun being with Chase, by the way. I just want you to know I'm a big fan. This much different, and you'll see why. I mean, my view is that I think I'm an economist. I look at the world from an economic standpoint seriously. And just going through the issues of what happened in the president's first term, and if I can, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was one of the most significant tax bills I've ever seen. It cut the corporate tax rate from 35% to 21%. It cut the personal income tax rate from 39.6 to 37. There were lots of other things. It reduced the estate tax dramatically. I'm a big tax cutter. I think that makes for more freedom better. The president, I believe, will follow through and do much more on taxes going forward. Another area that, and again, I'm just going to talk about economics, but he had a bill in Congress at the time, something called the Right to Try. People who are terminally ill have a right to avoid regulations and restrictions and requirements and choose any type of drug they wish to, whether it's been tested appropriately or not, if they are terminally ill. I can't see any argument against that. I thought that was great. That was one of his bills. It got passed, by the way, with a number of Democrats moving over and voting for it, especially Jared Polis, the governor of Colorado, who was my intern in California. The other one I think is really amazing with regard to economics. When COVID-19 hit, Trump released all the engines of government that he possibly could, removing all the regulations, restrictions, requirements, et cetera. He was able to get a COVID-19 vaccine through the whole process in 11 months, which is pretty amazing. They were estimating it would take 6 to 7, maybe 8 years. To get it through. The work done on that and mRNA, and I'm just going to mention this, it's a big reason for me. 2.5 years ago, my daughter, my number four, was diagnosed with 4-stage metastatic melanoma. They said she had about 11 weeks left to live. The tumors, the lesions down the spine. Because of the Operation Warp Speed and the work on mRNA, They had developed immune therapy drugs for metastatic melanoma. She went to MD Anderson. She is still alive today. The tumors have shrunk to about half the size. She's perfectly fit. I mean, for this, I am eternally grateful as a person. And I just want to say that that, to me, is a very important issue of getting this through the system. One other thing that the president gave me a little credit for was something called healthcare transparency. I was chairman of the board of Centennial Hospital in Nashville, Tennessee, and you can't believe how opaque and corrupt and disgusting the healthcare system is of the U.S. You have no knowledge of what the prices are, the transactions prices. They give you all these nonsense prices. You have no idea what the efficacy of these drugs are. They use something called HIPAA to mislead you, to thinking that it's incorrect to get information. Donald Trump put through an executive order which required hospitals and all medical prescribers in the system to post their transactions prices and to say what the efficacy was of the procedures there. We have not had by any means full disclosure from the hospitals, but if you look at what's happened to the U.S. over the last 50 years, the cost of healthcare as a share of GDP has risen dramatically in the U.S. We not only are the highest of the OECD, but we have had the biggest increase in healthcare costs as a share of GDP in the OECD. And as a wonderful little benefit of all that additional cost, we've had the largest drop in life expectancy of any country in the OECD as well. In the last 50 years, a big drop in life expectancy. My view is that if markets could be returned to the healthcare industry, we could save somewhere in the order of $1 trillion a year, 2 or 3 years out, 4 years out, and we could probably increase U.S. life expectancy by maybe 3 years just by moving back to markets. I think that's just a wonderful, wonderful procedure there. From the standpoint of economics, I think it's really imperative that we have decontrol of oil. I think the U.S. should be allowed to drill wherever they want to and do it. And let me just say, for those of you who are global warmers, Jill Stein, are you still back there? you may not be global warmers, but if you know the Bhagwati theorems, you know that you always have a direct cure for a direct problem. Drilling for oil and producing oil is not a pollutant. In fact, the U.S. is by far the cleanest producer of petroleum products in the world, much cleaner than Venezuela, Russia, or Saudi Arabia, or Iran, or these other countries, much better. If it's going to be produced, it might as well be produced here. When Trump did do the deregulation there, I think we were the only time that we have been energy independent in the U.S. as a result of that. I think that was wonderful. Just because you produce the oil does not mean you have to use it. This is the Bhagwati theorems. You want to really correct the problem, and the problem is not the production of oil. It's not. That's the solution. And when you look at this, I just have to say that with the unfreeing of oil production in the U.S., prices would be down quite substantially. That would not only make the U.S. Energy independent, but it would also really deprive some countries of the massive budgets they've had by keeping oil prices very high because the U.S. has prohibited production of energy. trade, I know everyone wants to talk about trade, but when you look at Trump, you've got to remember in this, and I think it's classic of his first term, that what Trump said is very different sometimes than what he does. Very different. And you know, while I take Trump very seriously, I don't take him literally by any means. If you take him literally, you'll die. I mean, you know, I find it funny as hell, but the people he makes fun of don't. And I can sort of understand that. But when you look at trade, my view is that with regard to threatening tariffs, on other countries. In fact, not only does he threaten tariffs, but that brings them to the table. If you look at the deals we've made with South Korea, with Japan, and with North America, they're pretty good free trade deals that we've had there. Look at what he does, not what he says, and I think that on trade, he really is very much of a free trader. Second from last point I'd like to make in this, and it's a serious point, is regulations in general. He has been very much of the deregulator. I've watched the numbers. I think it's nine getting rid of regulations for every one regulatory policy put in place. It's pretty impressive. And the last one I want to get, and again, remember, I'm an economist, and this is why I'm voting for the president, although I do love Chase, by the way, just for the record. I do. The Supreme Court picks. And I don't want to talk about the Supreme Court picks on terms of social issues or anything, but what they have done in driving, bringing down the regulatory bodies in the U.S. and depriving them from making rules and regulations on their own, I think is pretty impressive. So from my standpoint, I'm voting for Trump, and it's purely because of economics, and these policies to me are the keys. And with that, I would like to say thank you very much for giving me a chance to talk.
Sherry Oliver, you get the full 15 minutes to respond to the argument just made. Chase, take it away.
The first thing I do want to say is, if you have not noticed, I am not the octogenarian in this debate stage. I'm quite a bit younger. I know you're turning, you said 84 in 2 days. I'm turning 39 in 6 days, so I'm a little bit of the experience edge is going to go to Dr. Laffer here. But why am I here? First, I think we need to get a couple of things out of the way. I don't think we're arguing here of who is the most likely candidate to be elected president. I think if we did, both of us might be wrong based on what current polling is right now. I don't think we're talking about, who is the who's the best person to take on Kamala Harris. You know, I think if we were arguing that, there might be a different story. Here we're arguing over who would be the best choice for president. Your choice doesn't mean who's going to win. It means who has the best policies, who do we think would be the best ideas forward leading in Washington, D.C. I would argue that would be me. Obviously, I'm running for president. And the reason is because I think much of what the libertarian principles and libertarian platform put forward are things that we just don't hear out of Washington, D.C. these days. More and more, we feel like the Republican Party and the Democratic Party are really just two wings of the same bird. They are both very much interested in pushing their agenda, using the power of government, and in doing so, rack up debts and deficits every single year that we're seeing the effect of. And former President Trump, while he talked, you know, as he said, we don't need to take him on what he says, but on what he does. He said he was going to cut the debt in half in 8 years, and he actually racked the debts and deficits up more in 4 years than any president had done previously. Now, even taking COVID into account, which we can obviously say due to the spending that he also signed through there as well, even not taking COVID and the emergency into account, he was still tracking billions or trillions of dollars of deficit every year, and we weren't any meaningfully way reducing that impact. And that's actually what's driving the inflation we all feel. We're all feeling the inflation. I think it's wrong to attribute it solely to Joe Biden, because much of the inflation we're feeling is also the debt and deficit spending of the previous administration. This is why I argue we have to actually balance our federal budget. We actually have to cut enough of government to where we're not taking in, or we're taking in more than we're spending each and every year. This is something every American household has to do. And we're feeling the impact year over year. The inflation is something that is driving many people's reason to get out and vote. And unfortunately, neither of the major party candidates have any meaningful way to reduce inflation. I ran for Senate in 2022, and I ran against a guy named Raphael Warnock. And in our entire debate, he kept touting the Inflation Reduction Act, the Inflation Reduction Act. Well, we did this with the Inflation Reduction Act. And the only thing it didn't do was reduce inflation. And so again, we don't need to be taking politicians on the things they say, but on the actions they do and the things they pass. Now, we can look at what happened with the Trump tax cuts. Now, the Trump tax cuts did not produce the outcome of the Laffer curve. You know, they cut taxes, we did not get the corresponding growth or the corresponding reduction in spending, and we actually racked up higher deficits than we had before. And so I argue that the Trump economic policy is not one that's actually rooted in reducing debt and deficit, because if it were, he would be honest and talk about what is the highest driver of spending in this country and our federal budget, and that is the entitlements, that Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And those are things that Donald Trump has promised to not touch at all. He said, I won't mess with it at all. And I understand why he does this. Cynically, he does not want to lose the older voters who feel like their Medicare, their Medicaid, or their Social Security will be threatened. But for younger voters like myself, we see that and we say, hey, why can't we fix these problems before it falls off a cliff? Because right now, we're all paying into a Social Security program that people my age are just probably not going to get to see the benefits of in any real meaningful way. And so for me, if we were being serious about getting the economy under control, getting spending under control, producing a growth environment that doesn't involve trillions of dollars of debt and deficit spending, we would have a president that would address these issues. Sadly, we do not. What we do, he's just running as the libertarian candidate, which is why I argue Donald Trump is not the best choice for president. I'm also a pro-free trader. I work in, before I got into politics, I actually worked for a large maritime logistics firm. My job was directly dependent on global trade because it was about facilitating moving goods from one part of the world to the other. And Donald Trump, and through his tariffs and through his economic policy, has inhibited this, particularly with trade with China, which is one of the largest trading partners we have. They're the largest producer and exporter in the world, and they're somebody that we want to continue trading with, because when you're trading with people, I'd rather trade goods than bullets with people. And I think if we continue to invest in a relationship with China, we can actually stave off the possibility of one day having a war with China. And so I think we actually need to tear down these protectionist trade barriers, because ultimately tariffs are not paid by China. They are paid by each and every one of us when we buy goods. They make the cost of buying things more expensive. That makes the cost of running your business more expensive. It means you have to charge people more money, and again, leads to inflationary practices. I want to keep costs low by supporting free trade 100%. And, I think oftentimes this is done out of this protectionist nature of, well, we need to protect American jobs. Like I said, I worked in the maritime trading industry. When you move a textile, say, from Vietnam to your store shelf in Walmart, it gets on a ship, and then it gets unloaded by longshoremen who are American workers. It gets put onto a truck that's driven by an American worker. It's taken to a rail yard that's facilitated by American workers, put on a train. The engineer is an American worker. It then comes off the rail yard into another truck, driven by an American worker, taken to a warehouse, worked by American workers, then taken on another truck to go to your final store that is manned by American workers that you, an American consumer, are buying from. Global trade and free trade creates American jobs in this country. It creates prosperity, and it lowers the cost of doing business across the board. This is why we need to have a president who supports these things, instead of having protectionists whispering in his ear, telling him what he thinks is good and what he thinks will punish China and what he thinks will harm other people. And that is my other problem, is that Donald Trump is not consistent. He is very much prone to suggestion. Anybody who, if you've seen the way Donald Trump governs, a lot of times it seems erratic, and it's because many times he is governing on the last good idea that he thinks is a good idea that was brought in front of him. This is why we have the erratic foreign policy of, well, I didn't start any new wars, but of course I sold billions and billions of dollars of arms to Saudi Arabia and to others to fight wars elsewhere. It's why we see this erratic, governance with regards to the economy, where he talks about protecting American jobs, but costing American jobs and making the cost of running a small business more expensive on the other end. I want to deregulate. I do. I think deregulation is a good thing. And we've seen some deregulation out of Donald Trump, but certainly not as much as we could have. And certainly if we had somebody who was more forceful in deregulation, we can see a better fighter for that. And I would argue that a libertarian in the White House would be the greatest deregulatory four-year period that we would ever have in this country. And so I don't believe that Donald Trump is the best choice for president, and I'm not putting him up against his opponent Harris. I'm putting him up against his opponent who is myself and others in the process, and I think voters have better choices on their ballot. I would argue, even if you're not voting for me, there are probably better choices on the ballot who are not named Donald Trump or Kamala Harris for you to pick from. And so for me, this is a very easy argument to make. Is the Democrat or Republican ever the best candidate in the race? I would argue not very often, because the Democrat and Republican parties are corrupt to the very core, and they actually push the lowest quality candidates forward each and every election, which is why we have less and less quality, less and less approval of these candidates as we go forward, and it's because the system itself is corrupted. People will always accuse me of being a spoiler because I'm a libertarian. They say, you're going to take votes from somebody to help somebody else win, you're a spoiler. And my response to that is always the same. I can't spoil something that's already completely rotten to the core. And that is our two-party system as it exists in Washington, D.C. So I would wager, and I would argue, that the better choice for you to make as voters is to dare to vote differently. Dare to vote outside of a broken two-party system and send a signal to Democrats and Republicans that the quality that they are giving you on the ballot is not the quality that you want to see as a voter. And I bet when you do that, I guarantee you, when you make it hurt for the Democratic and Republican parties, they will become a heck of a lot more responsive to the needs of you, the voters, and not the people who back them, their corporate lobbyist partners who buy and trade congressmen like cattle at an auction yard. And so, in summation, I would like to say this. You can choose Donald Trump if you want. You can choose Kamala Harris if you want. But you're not going to get anything meaningfully different from what the two-party system has provided you your entire life. Division, hyper-partisanship, and lower quality results, more and more debt, and more war around the world. So in summation, please think differently, please vote differently, and I urge you to vote libertarian. Thank you.
Thank you, Chase. 5 minutes of rebuttal from the opponent here. You can take the podium if you'd like. Take it away. Or you want to do it from the chair or from the podium?
I'll do it from the chair this time. Can all of you hear me all right?
Yeah.
Is that all right to do it here? Yeah. Just the one thing on trade, if I may. You know, negotiating strategies are very, very different than beliefs in how you get there. Trump has told me many times that the reason you threaten trade barriers, the reason you threaten tariffs, is to bring them to the table. The only thing these other countries are, who are much more protectionist than we are, the only thing that brings them to the table is the thought that they might lose access to the U.S. market. And, you know, this is the logic he gave to me personally, told me about. And, you know, if I didn't have additional information on it, I might take it with a grain of salt. But at the G7 meeting in Ottawa, up in Canada, just before he met with Kim Jong-un, Trump had to lead the meeting early to get to Singapore to meet with Kim Jong-un. And he said one thing. He said, please forgive me for leaving this meeting early. I know it is a problem, please, but you really want me to go to Singapore to meet with this and making sure we don't have the threats. And he said, but I have one thing to tell you before I leave. And he looked at the six other participants in the meeting. He said, the U.S. today is prepared to uncategorically get rid of all tariffs and all non-tariff barriers if you guys will get rid of your tariffs and your non-tariff barriers. And there was dead silence in the room. A couple of them were whistling, looking up at the air. The others were looking at their shoes, and he left. You know, that is not a protectionist president to make that offer. That is how do you get from here to there, not what you like. Free trade, Donald Trump is a free trader all the way. He ran an international business totally in the global economy, which I don't know of any global company run by the CEO that doesn't love free trade. And the one point I made otherwise to him one day, I said, how can anyone who imported two foreign wives not be a free trader? He did not think that was funny.
5 minutes rebuttal from you. Chelsea, take it away.
So on the argument of free trade, you know, it's about what he says and what he does. And you know, if your argument is, well, he's only saying these things, he's not really serious about it. I think our international neighbors are going to know that very quickly, and they're not going to come to the table because you have to actually follow through on your threats, and that's part of dealing in business. And you're right, Donald Trump is an international businessman. He created many businesses and worked across the world. Nowadays, I suppose if he were, I guess his ties are getting a 20% tariff now because they're from China, maybe. But for me, you know, what I see is somebody who continuously tries to needle our international neighbors. I continue trying to divide and say, well, America's exceptional, China's terrible, they're going to lead to this war, this, that, and the other. We're going to punish China. And the truth is I don't think that's the best way to actually cool relations with China. In fact, I think the best thing we can do is actually call China's bluff with trade. Right now, they're pumping up their currency, they're manipulating their marketplaces. Keep trading with them as much as possible. Keep feeding into that bubble. Let that bubble keep blowing up, and eventually it will burst. And when it does, what you're going to see is a very angry population of China who's very angry at their government for basically ruining their economy, putting them into a recession and depression, which is on the way for China. It is in the works. It will be happening over the next decade. And when that happens, I hope what we see is a Chinese population who cries out for market liberalism from their government, who uses the catastrophe to actually build something better for themselves. And the people of China are going to have to do that. But with regards to international trade, I think the proof is in the pudding that Donald Trump is very much invested in putting up some of these tariffs if he feels they are worth it, if he feels it's going to protect American jobs. And I would just argue that they don't. The tariffs don't protect American jobs. They cost American jobs. They cost American businesses. And they make the cost of buying goods go up. And so the best way to engage in a trade war, quote unquote, with China is to keep trading with them, to trade with them more, and to continue to pump up this bubble that they're about to burst and speed this along, as opposed to trying to create protectionist policies that will somehow, in some magical way, benefit American firms. For me, I like the fact that I work in an industry that is solely created and solely functions based on international trade, and I see the impact of that on a daily basis, how many people that employs, how many people that helps. And I would really, you know, I would hope that, and I hope that Donald Trump cares about these things. I'm going to take him at his word that he does. I just think that he needs better advice with regards to some of these policies. And for me, again, it's erratic. It's about whoever talks into his ear the latest. You know, maybe if Dr. Laffer were like attached to Donald Trump at the hip, we would get his economics all the time. But sadly, that's not the case. We're going to get a lot of other people talking to his ear, including those protectionists. And he's just way too prone to suggestion. Libertarians, on the other hand, you can pretty much know where a libertarian is going to go before you even meet that libertarian. Should the government? No, they shouldn't. Right? It's pretty much easy to read our platform. We have a much shorter and much easier to read platform than, say, these other parties. And so when you see a libertarian talking about economic policy, you pretty much know they're going to be free traders, free marketers, voluntary exchange all the way around, and reducing the regulations, the tariffs, anything that inhibits market growth. And so when you vote libertarian, you're voting for something that is much more predictable, something that the markets will know and be much more predictable and be able to predict, and you'll have a much less erratic economic policy than you would from either a Donald Trump or, let's be frank, the Democrats as well. Thank you.
Thank you both. We now go to the Q&A section of the evening. There's a microphone over there, and you can line up to ask your questions. Please raise your question as a question. I'm going to begin with moderator's prerogative and ask each candidate a particular question. Chase, question for you, and of course you can comment on it, Art, once Chase gives his answer. You're absolutely right that the resolution can be interpreted to talk about the best choice, the best choice independent of who is the most likely choice to win. But would you permit me for a moment to point out that there's a certain ambiguity when you say best choice, and that the best choice concept could mean who is the lesser evil, that the best choice is the lesser evil, and that since Chase Oliver is unlikely to win, and since it's going to be a Democrat or a Republican, would you concede that while Trump is evil and Kamala is evil, Trump is the lesser evil?
So I was actually asked a similar question at the Libertarian National Convention by a group called The Good Liars. They are a group that satirizes politicians. They came to satirize libertarians. It's actually quite a funny video if you have a sense of humor about yourself. And he asked me the question. He said, gun to your head, Donald Trump or Joe Biden, who do you vote for? And I said the gun would go off. And I'm sincere when I say that. There are, I'm sure, policies that I think Trump would be better than Harris on. I'm sure I could probably think deep down and find policies that Harris might be better than Trump on.
Could you elaborate on those? Harris is better than Trump on what?
She's got better hair. She's a little younger. No, honestly, to me, economics-wise, obviously, limited government conservatism is preferable to big government, more spending. But I would also argue that Donald Trump was a big government, big spender. He wasn't exactly as conservative. Ronald Reagan, he was not. And so I would argue to me that no matter who wins between the two of them, the debt and deficit will grow. We will still continue to see hyper-partisanship and division. And so for me, maybe I'm the pessimist in the room, but I don't feel like we're going to get a whole lot friendlier and a whole lot more united as a country, regardless of who wins. And to me, it's really hard for me to say one is better than the other. A, I'm running against both of them, so I don't like to give either of them a preference in my ranked choice vote. But B, you know, to me, Donald Trump has just not lived up to, you know, many of the promises that the conservatives who've backed him have said he did. So I'm not one to not be a fan of either one. The gun would go off yet again.
Yes. Any comment from you on that response, on that question? Do you want to pass?
Just a quick one on the negotiation there. I do agree with you on free trade. In fact, I'm a trade economist. I'm totally free trade, and I'm very much against sanctions and all that. Totally with you on that. But when it comes to negotiation, I think Trump would do a better job than you would. But you would do the second best job there.
Question for you, Art. It was made public on a very interesting podcast that I recommend, in which John Mackey was talking to Matt Kibbe. And he expressed a viewpoint that there are certain deal breakers, certain unforgivables that make it impossible for you to pull the lever for a president. And he made the point that Trump shut down, effectively shut down the world economies for no good reason, and on top of that has shown no remorse for having done so. And so he felt that this is a deed that is so alien to libertarianism, such a power grab on the part of government, and not repudiated by Trump even to this day, that he said, I couldn't possibly pull the lever for Trump for that reason alone. What might you have to say to John Mackey in response?
Yeah, I think he's got his facts incorrect, to be very honest with you. I mean, Trump made it very clear in the U.S. That the governors were in charge. He made it very clear. In fact, he was also clear that he wanted Georgia shut down. And the governor of Georgia was very clear that he did not want Georgia shut down. There was a lot of wordplay between the two of them. And Georgia was not shut down. If you look at other states like Colorado, I mentioned Jared Polis in Colorado, totally opened the state. Trump let this be a decision that was made by governors, not by him, even though he expressed his own views on it. And you're very correct on that. He did not impose those views on the states. He just plain didn't. And it was his decision to allow the states autonomy on whether they shut down or not. Now, do I think they should have shut down? Hell no. Completely no. But I'm not in charge of everything everywhere at all times, even though I should be. But that's the way I would take the answer there, if I may, that he was the one who gave the not shut down choice to the states.
Any comment from you, Chase, on that?
So I would argue, again, this is a matter of Trump listening to the person that's closest to his ear. He listened to people that said, hey, recommend these shutdowns, and governors, of course, follow suit. You know, they're going to, if they hear the president recommending something, that gives them the cover they need to lock down their state, to lock down their businesses. And thousands of businesses disappeared that never came back. I had a friend who lost her small business because it was deemed unessential. She sold flowers, but yet now she works for the Lowe's Garden Center because they were allowed to stay open. So she works for the corporate man instead of owning a small business. That's a story that we hear across the board. And yeah, Georgia was locked down for a few weeks, and when Brian Kemp tried to open it back up, Trump very quickly got in front of a microphone and chided how irresponsible Brian Kemp was for opening the state as early as he did. And I'm thankful that Brian Kemp, frankly, we should have never been locked down at all, but I'm thankful that Georgia was opened up as soon as it was, because the economic impact we had was far less than in states like New York and California and others that had terrible, draconian, horrible lockdowns. Your governors are terrible. And, you know, I'm thankful that we were able to open ourselves and that we could make those decisions for ourselves, obviously, because if a federal government tried to lock us down, that'd be a violation of the kind of federalism there. But Trump led the way on saying he thinks this is a good idea. He thinks this is going to slow the spread. And it didn't. It did not slow the spread in states that were more locked down than others. There was not less transmission rate. There were still just as many people roughly getting sick in California as there were in Texas. And so for me, it was a waste of time. It killed many businesses. And it's just another example of Donald Trump taking the advice that's closest to him, that he thinks is a good idea, that he thinks sounds good, without really following through on what the true economic impact would be. And lockdowns are the thing he needs to be held to account the most. And unfortunately, his Democratic opponent won't be doing that, because she was just right alongside him saying, this is a great idea. 14 days to stop the spread turns in 6 months to stop the spread. And so for me, we don't have a fighter who's fighting against those lockdowns, because Trump has never, ever held himself responsible for that. He's never, ever said, these were a bad idea, this hurt our communities, this hurt our economy. And if he's not brave enough to say that with all the data pushing back to him, if he can't admit he's wrong, that is not leadership. And to be a true leader is to admit when you've done wrong, when you've said wrong, and hold yourself accountable for it. And, you know, I would like to see that from the former president.
question then. Please ask your question as a question. Take it away, sir.
My question is for Chase Oliver. Kamala Harris came out today against taxing tips or gifts, and Trump did that 2 months ago, but he also was against taxing Social Security benefits. My question for you is, if you're the better candidate, what are you not going to tax?
Well, first I want to say, you know, I worked in restaurants for 13 years. That was my first job, was being a dishwasher, and I'd been a server. I've lived off of tips a lot. And I'm happy to say that, you know, libertarians have been wanting to remove the tax on tips for a long period of time. Representative Massey, who is a small L libertarian, is the one who wrote the bill in Congress to get that done. I would happily sign on to that. But let's talk about taxation is theft. Taxation is government taking money out of your wallet to reallocate those resources in a very inefficient way. And so libertarians want to get rid of the income tax. We basically want to get rid of any amount of taxation as we can while also cutting government, because it's not just about cutting the taxes. As much as I would like to cut all taxes, we also have to correspondingly cut spending, or else we're creating inflation through debt and deficit spending, and that's its own kind of immoral tax that the Republicans and Democrats right now are just happy to see hitting your wallet, because they don't have to vote for it. They just have to keep voting for spending. So if I were the candidate who's elected president, I would want to eliminate taxes as much as possible, but it has to come with being responsible and cutting spending. Cutting taxes alone will not get us out of the debt and deficits that we're in. And so for me, if we're going to be truly moral about it, we have to not only cut taxes, but cut the spending too, so we're not taxing people through inflation.
Comment from you on that question or answer.
Yeah, I think what I would prefer of all is a low-rate, broad-based, flat tax with no exemptions, exclusions, et cetera, just a flat tax. Something along the lines that Jerry Brown ran on in 1992 in the Democratic primary, the 13% flat tax to replace all federal taxes except for sin taxes. But when you look at it here, I wouldn't look at individuals. Now, campaign slogans are one thing. You accuse Trump of pushing people by arguing one position even though they have the right to choice. And then you chide him for making another one, making the same. But the truth of the matter is, campaign slogans are, I think Trump will lower tax rates, broaden the tax base, and get consensus there on major tax rate reductions in the U.S., and really spur economic growth. I think government spending would be a lot less today if we'd never had COVID-19. He made a mistake on that. I talked with him at great length. My suggestion to him, which was a dollar short and a day late, but my suggestion was we get rid of the payroll tax for 18 months and have the same amount of total deficit, but we do it pro-growth, pro-employment. That was the solution there. There was going to be something happening. So that's where I am. But you shouldn't criticize a person for the words all the time. You have to look at those deeds. And giving the rights to the governors to make the decisions about lockdowns was the right decision for him to do, my view of the world. He never would have gotten it done through Congress, by the way.
Next question.
Thank you. This is both for Art and Chase. Do you believe that Donald Trump was responsible for the January 6th attack on Congress? And if so, what should have been done about it?
I'll take that.
You know, let me just say, I don't know anything about that, to be honest with you. I really don't. I'm an economist. I do know economics. But I know nothing about what happened on January 6th. I watched the sham. It's embarrassing to watch it. But I really don't know anything. This is a good question for Chase, who will be much more than just an economist.
Chase?
So, you know, is he responsible for it? I don't know. Did he continue to spur it on, and did he continue to stoke the flames? Absolutely, I can say he did, because he continued the lie that he somehow won the 2020 election. And I hate to say it, but he lost. He lost the state of Georgia. And yeah, as a Republican losing the state of Georgia in a presidential election, that should be pretty embarrassing. Maybe he doesn't want to admit it, but he did lose that election. And if he had admitted his loss and conceded defeat, you would have never had January 6th happen. And so for the fact that he did not admit that he had lost that election, he tried to continue to say, oh, well, these irregularities here, these irregularities there. Every court that he argued it in front of didn't see anything there. And there were a lot of Trump-appointed judges that were seeing those cases. And so it's not a matter of bias. And so the best way to have prevented anything from happening on January 6th is for the person who loses the election to admit they lost the election. We have a problem with that also in the state of Georgia. Stacey Abrams, who ran for governor, didn't want to admit she lost the election to Brian Kemp. So it's not just a one-party thing anymore. I think we need to get back to being graceful in defeat. And when we lose an election, be man enough or woman enough to admit that fact. And I also think on January 6th, you know, he could have more quickly gone and, you know, in front of the public and said, stop what you're doing. This isn't right. go home, don't try to do this. I mean, I'm a libertarian, man. I mean, if we're going to be attacking the Capitol, it needs to be a heck of a lot better reasons than to help Donald Trump become president. I'm no lover of government, but I think what we saw on January 6th certainly could have been prevented if Donald Trump had just admitted that he lost the election.
Next question.
So my question is for Professor Laffer. The topic of foreign intervention hasn't come up in this debate. My question is, why is Donald Trump the best candidate to guide the U.S. through the various developing world conflicts, in particular Russia and Ukraine, Israel and Hamas, and the U.S. and China?
My view is, very simply, is a slogan that the president I worked for very closely, Ronald Reagan, did, which speaks a peace through strength, is the issue there. And strength here is not how to jog 5 miles. It's not doing 312 push-ups. Strength is a strong, strong, strong economy. And with regard to that, I think Trump much better off with a strong economy. Now, my colleague and dear friend and Nobel laureate Bob Mundell made the point that it was the Smoot-Hawley tariff that precipitated and caused the Great Depression. It was the Great Depression that precipitated and caused World War II. I'm very much along the lines there. I guess if I can say where I come out on the war issues, and I do come out on this, is that I'm going to give you a Kennedy quote, not a Bobby Kennedy, but a Jack Kennedy quote, if I may. The best form of defense spending is always wasted. Whenever you find yourself in a situation where you were required to use your military hardware and prowess, that is a clear sign you did not spend enough. Putting locks on your doors is not wasted money. The reason you have a strong defense and a strong economy is so that you don't have to use your weapons, so that you don't get into a Gaza situation, so that you don't get into a Ukraine situation, you don't get into a Houthi rebel situation. In his 4 years in office, with the increase in defense spending and the great economic policies, my view, and this is my view here, that Donald Trump literally prevented any new wars from breaking out that we got involved in. There was no Ukraine. Believe me, if Trump had been in the second term, there would have been no Ukraine war, my view. There would have been no Gaza incursion, my view again, if Trump had been president. And in my view, the Houthi rebels would not have made it as well, again, if Trump had had the second term. So my view here is that I really think Trump would be one to lead to a far more peaceful world by increasing defense spending, having a stronger economy and a healthier economy with tax cuts and policies, and it's those indirect effects that you really want to have. There's nothing that comes close to having peace in our time. And the nice thing about Ronald Reagan was it literally Ronald Reagan's peace. And do I have a few seconds more? Let me give one that I remember sitting there with the president-elect, not with the president-elect, he wasn't even president, he was governor. This is 1979 at the Beverly Hills Hotel. There were about 10 of us there, and Reagan was the governor then, and he had asked Dick Allen. We are 10 of us, and we had a visitor from Israel at the time at the lunch, and asked Dick Allen to give a summary sort of U.S. economic military policy in the post-World War II era, and Dick Allen had quite a good sense of humor. So what he said, well, you see, sir, we've been doing basically two things since World War II. We've been harassing our friends, and we've been cajoling our enemies. And we were all rolling with laughter, but Dick Allen's really very funny, and we did, but the president, the governor at the time, wasn't laughing. He said, well, Dick, what did you say? What was that you just said? He said, sir, we've been cajoling our enemies and harassing our friends. And again, just hesitated, and the governor looked at him and said, you know, what's been the concept? What's been the consequences of those policies? He said, well, sir, we have two consequences. We have no friends left, but we have lots of enemies, sir. And Reagan just quickly just sort of blurted out, and I'm going to use modern-day terminology, if I may, on this. Reagan just blurted out. He said, well, I guess we're just going to have to reverse those policies now, aren't we? We're going to have to scare the bejabers out of our enemies with Star Wars and make our friends stinking rich with supply-side economics. And, you know, that, to me, is the key to world peace. is. You have a very strong economy, and you have a very strong military. And, you know, no one will take you on, and they want to be your friend because they like making money from you. They like making money from you, and they don't like fighting you. And this is the role I think Donald Trump would have in the world economy. And I think we would quickly get rid of the wars in Ukraine, Gaza, and Houthis, plus all the others. I think there's only one person who can really bring peace in the Far East as well, with Taiwan and China. And that to me, is Donald Trump. But that's me.
Comment from you, Chelsea, on that question.
Well, I got my start in politics being an anti-war protester. You know, what I'm really sick and tired of is seeing politicians and bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. send people, young people, to go fight in militarized wars around the world. That's the foreign policy that we've seen since 2001, is that there's no problem we can't solve with a bullet or a war. There are thousands of people who are not here today because of the war in Iraq that was CIA manipulated, that was cherry-picking data to push our people into a war that we didn't need to be in. And that's what we continue to see from the national security state in this country. They continue to find enemies for us to fight. They continue to find conflicts for us to interject ourselves into. And it is not for the benefit of the United States. It's not for making us safer. It's for making the military-industrial complex firms more wealthy. That is why we continue to push this peace through strength kind of foreign policy. I would argue right now that we need to see a reduction in our militarism around the world. We need to be removing our military footprint and increasing our trade and increasing engagement and voluntary exchange with other nations, that the balance there is way, way off in the favor of the bomb, the bullet, and the drone. And that has caused distrust of this country. That has caused people to distrust our population, to distrust our government, to create hatred for our populations that should not exist. We should not be backing the government of Israel in this war, because there are tens of thousands of people who are now dead because of the policy in which they have responded. That doesn't mean they don't have a chance to respond when there's a terrorist attack on their soil. Lord knows if October 7th had happened here in the United States, much as we had a terror attack in 2001, we would want to respond. But just like we should have had a friend on September the 12th respond to us saying, we know you're grieving, we know you're hurt, and we know you want to fight, and we know you're angry, this policy of a 20-year-plus war on terror is not going to make the world a safer place for the average person. It's going to actually destabilize markets and destabilize nations around the world. Similarly, we should have on October 8th said, the policy of airstriking the people of Gaza, killing tens of thousands of people, will turn the international community against you. It will create massive protests, both here in the United States and around the world, against your government. And if you want to make the average Israeli safer, you need to be more surgical in your strike. Take out Hamas. Yes, take out the terrorists. But killing this many people is not creating more goodwill for the government and certainly for the people of Israel, and that is a shame. And we need to have a leader who's willing to step forward and say, no more war. We need more peace in the world.
Did you want another round on that?
Just a very quick. I think this is the real difference. You know, I think the peace through strength is preventing the Gaza attack, not preventing the response to it. I think the peace through strength is making damn sure the Russians don't line up in the Ukraine border to go into Ukraine, not supporting them once they do that. The same thing with the Houthi rebels, the same thing with the Iraq war. I'm very much against war. I have been all my life, especially when there was a draft and I was of age. I was really against it. Just joking. But this is the difference. Do you think peace through strength means a strong military and economic growth prevents those events from occurring? Or do you think it's really how you respond once those events occur? And that's where I think the difference between you and me is. And it's a very reasonable discussion. I think we're both very much against war. And the question is, how do you succeed in preventing war from beginning? And that's where I would say I'm the Kennedy, Trump, Reagan position, and you're the other position of getting the military way down in strength. And that's where the difference is.
Peace and strength.
Yeah, just a really quick rebuttal here. So you mentioned that, like, if Trump were president, October 7th would have never happened, but we're still funding Israel to the same billions and billions of dollars every year. We're still giving them the same military hardware under Biden that we did under Trump. It's not as if the government of Israel was less prepared to defend themselves and less prepared to create an offensive war. The Biden government is just as much backing Israel as any other American government that's ever existed. It is, you know, almost without saying that, you know, every candidate for president is full-throatedly backing Israel right now. I support Israel's right to exist. I support the people of Israel, but I'm going to be the only one, really. Maybe Jill Stein, are you back there? She might also be the only one willing to call out the Netanyahu government for the wrongs they are doing. and how that actually harms that can possibly harm the safety of the average Israeli's life. And so I would argue whether Trump was president in his second term or not, Hamas doesn't care. They don't really care. They wanted to kill innocent people, and they were going to do that. And they were going to do that while the government was funding Israel with billions and billions of dollars worth of arms. I don't think it made a difference. I think October 7th would have happened under Trump, but I think what you would be seeing under Donald Trump right now is a full-throated saying, kill them all. He would be saying, peace through strength. When you got to fight, you got to kill them all, and you have to be... Don't discriminate against it. Just carpet bomb them, and that would seriously be the that would be the foreign policy you would see if an October 7th happened with someone with the temperament of Donald Trump being president.
That's the big disagreement, by the way. That is the real disagreement here tonight.
Yep, I think strength through peace.
Okay, next question.
Hi, yes, this is a question for Dr. Laffer. So I heard you mention that among the developed OECD nations, the U.S. has the highest medical costs. Correct.
As a share of GDP.
Yes. So I have a question related to that. You also mentioned that under the Trump administration, corporate taxes were cut quite a bit. And obviously those corporate taxes do affect big monopolic medical companies. So my question to you is, do you agree or not that maybe those tax cuts, since they were across the board affecting monopolic medical companies as well, that also created the conditions to further increase medical costs in the U.S.?
Not really. I mean, I do separate. I mean, a tax cut across the board affects everyone across the board, and every industry, good ones, bad ones, or the other ones. The one thing I think is really not said tonight, if I may, just from the numbers, and this is numbers, not how you feel. Facts are facts. The U.S. Tax revenues from the inception of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in 2019 in December. For the next 2 years, tax revenues rose by more than they had in the prior 2 years there, that the tax cuts literally paid for themselves 100%, that the increase was more than it had been in the prior 2 years. If you look at the unemployment rates, we hit all-time lows in unemployment rates for, I mean, I could go through all the minority groups and everything. Poverty in the U.S. was at its lowest rate ever. U.S. growth, which had been going along with Europe even right up until the December of 2019, all of a sudden separated. By 2 years later, our GDP was 2.5% higher than it would have been had we continued growing right simultaneously with the EU. So I think those Tax Cuts and Jobs Act not only didn't hurt the economy, they made it the deficit less, not more. Now the spending, Chase is completely correct, on unwarranted, unbridled government spending is a problem. But it wasn't the tax cut that led to those deficits. Far from it. Tax cut led to a much better position than would have been without those tax cuts.
Comment?
Yeah, so just quickly, the things that I would like to see in our healthcare marketplace to lower those costs for the average consumer, let's allow people to buy health insurance across state lines. Let's allow people to buy drugs across national borders so we can lower the cost of drugs here in the United States. And let's finally remove the barriers and the regulations that allow these monopolies to exist, namely patent evergreening of drugs that allow drugs like insulin to remain extremely expensive and not allow generics to get on the marketplace. This patent evergreening has led to so many drugs that if they were allowed to have generics, you would see them right now on Mark Cuban's website for the cost of production plus 15%, and people would be saving thousands and thousands of dollars a year on drugs. And so what hampers and what makes medical costs so expensive, what creates these monopolies, are the very regulations that we need to be fighting against. And I hope no matter who is president in the future, we can look at the possibility of cutting these regulations so that households can have lower costs of impact in healthcare as a portion of their household income. It is growing so much faster than the rate of inflation. Is this because it is one of the marketplaces that government most inserts itself into? And you can see this across the board. Education is the same way. The more government sticks its very visible hand into the marketplace, the more the invisible hand gets swatted away and the higher costs rise, and we need to have a president who's brave enough to say this and who's not bought and paid for by the pharmaceutical companies and the insurance companies, because it will hurt their bottom line. It will make it where they have lower profit margins, but what that will do is make costs less for each and every American and improve our healthcare outcomes altogether.
Gene, can I quit just quick? This is another major disagreement. Not a disagreement. I agree with everything you just said. I don't think that's the reason we have high medical care. I don't think that's the reason why our costs as a share of GDP have gone up. I don't think that's why our life expectancy
efficiency has dropped relative to the OECD, it's because you don't know what the prices are for the things you're buying from medical providers. You have no clue. Your doctor doesn't have a clue. And you have no clue as to the efficacy of these drugs and operations. They need to post their transactions prices in the marketplace. And once they do that, competition will be brought back in. If you look at the disparity, even within a city, of a same proposition, you will find that the prices vary by a factor of 10, depending upon the insurance company, depending upon the thing. It's just outrageous. We need to have a marketplace that works by knowing what prices are and what the qualities are, and that is where you will get your solution. You're right on your suggestions, but that's not the cause of this. The cause is we don't have a good marketplace in healthcare.
He's right. Advertised pricing, advertised outcomes is exactly what we want. It's exactly what folks like Gary Johnson and myself have been running on for a long time. In addition, we also, I believe that healthcare savings accounts should no caps on that, because the cap is far lower than what the average cost is for Americans, and they should be able to spend healthcare without taxation.
Next question.
This question is primarily for Mr. Oliver. I think a lot of the objection, a lot of the objection to your candidacy, I think in certain quarters of the Libertarian Party, in certain quarters of the right, has been on culture war grounds. And I think a lot of it has to do not even necessarily with policy positions, but personal predispositions or whatever. What do you say to those who find the culture war issues as their most salient point this time around? And how do you think we get to a point where that's not what everybody's thinking about?
So I'm somebody who... So yes,
culture war issues.
He said some folks have issues around culture war issues with my campaign, personal beliefs, what have you. What do I say to address those concerns? First, I think, you know, I've always called for a culture war ceasefire. I don't like to see a war happening, because a war happening to me is when government is using their power to try to push one position or another. And so I seek to have a culture war ceasefire where we take government out of the equation of these culture war questions altogether. Let's have a free cultural exchange of ideas. Now, as the candidate for president with the Libertarian Party, I may have personal opinions and personal views, but what I am trying to do is represent the entire Libertarian Party and the breadth of our philosophy. And so I have to take my own personal views to take a backseat and argue the philosophy and the principles that we're fighting for, and there will be people who make decisions that agree with me, people who make decisions that disagree with me, but the nature of liberty is that if you're living in peace, it shouldn't matter as long as you're living in peace if you live differently than I do. And so that's the kind of nature I'm fighting for, that's the kind of conditions that I'm fighting for, is let this not be happening in the realm of government, let culture war be happening in the realm of free cultural exchange idea, and may the best ideas win.
Unfortunately, guys, let's see, everybody else, yeah. Guys, we have actually run out of time on questions, but we will give you the opportunity to ask a question, and then it might be addressed in the summations. So please ask a question, and then we'll see how it will be addressed later. Go ahead, take it away. What's your question?
I suspect that many people with libertarian ideals would say that Donald Trump is a more libertarian candidate than Kamala Harris, based if only on foreign war position in Ukraine and Supreme Court originalists, but they would probably agree more overall with your platform, Chase. Given that we have an electoral college system, and last I checked, we have at least 7 swing states, Georgia, Arizona, Michigan, Wisconsin, Nevada, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, I suspect that many people, if they're in a swing state, will vote for Trump. If they're not, they will vote for Chase. What do both of you think of that strategy?
Those in the swing states will vote for Trump and Chase. Next question.
Simple question. Why do you think Donald Trump failed to drain the swamp?
Failed to drain the swamp. Okay, next question.
Trump threatened to pull out of NATO, and he effectively pulled out of the Paris Accords and decreased official development aid to the Third World during his presidency. So what do you think are the effects of pulling out of these international organizations on the United States' image as a global hegemon, if Trump does that during his second presidency?
Trump being a global hegemon. And then we have a final question.
Donald Trump has proposed in the 2024 campaign much more extreme tariffs than previously. That includes a 60% tariff on all Chinese goods and 100% on all Chinese cars, 50% on cars made in Mexico in Chinese factories there, and a 10% tariff on every good from every other country on the planet. Presumably, the argument for him would be, well, don't take him literally. Why not? Like, he loves tariffs. Why not take him literally when he says he's going to make lots more tariffs?
All right. Those questions are probably questions you'll want to take into account in your summations. Art, you are the affirmative, so you go first on the summations. Take it away.
Wait a second. I went first on the first one.
I can go first.
Yeah, come on. Jeez.
Okay, guys, I did the research. I'm doing Oxford-style rules. You get an advantage when you go first, and the negative gets the advantage by going last. So you go first.
We both get the advantage. Isn't that wonderful? It's great. Yeah, I don't know what to say. You heard my arguments on economics. I think Trump, if we elect Trump, he'd be a better president than the candidates today. But let me just tell you, I'm a big fan of Chase's, and I think you would be a great president. I think Trump would be a better one at getting the things done that I would like to see done on the economics and on the military. But that's where we are. You've heard all the arguments. You know very well that I don't believe Trump wants to put 50, 60, 100% tariffs on China, but he does want China to come to the negotiation table and make a free trade agreement with us. You know that. I was the first person to go to China in modern times. I went in October of 1970 with George Shultz and John Ehrlichman in Air Force Two. I went there fully convinced that China was our major enemy. I'm a Midwesterner, conservative. And when I went there and saw China and did all that, I fell in love with China. I think there's no country that can benefit the U.S. more with free trade than China can with the U.S. I'm 100% against all sanctions against any countries. In fact, my view is that I think that we should trade more with countries we don't like just to have the interaction with them and to be able to share ideas and do that. I mean, Russia trade, China trade, Iranian trade, North Korean trade is really essential for making sure peace occurs in this world. That's where I come from. I think Trump would be very good on those levels as well, but that's my view. I think, Chase, if you were there, I think you'd probably be pretty good on it too, if you could get it through, but I'd vote for Trump.
Chase, take it away.
Well, first I want to say thank you for coming out and debating here today. Thank you, Gene, for having us both here. I think this has been a great exchange of ideas. You know, obviously, I don't think that Donald Trump is the best choice for president. Otherwise, I would not be running for president. But what I hope that we've had is a good exchange of ideas, and what I hope folks can see is that people who disagree on who you're going to vote for in November can still come together in some sort of peaceful discourse and actually argue that out. To the person who was arguing about strategic voting, I urge you to really think about what that strategy is. If you're in a swing state, you know, maybe I'll vote for Trump because I'm scared that Kamala Harris will win. You know, I think what we need to be looking for is to be a little bit braver to demand better quality candidates across the board, that we can't lower ourselves and lower our expectations out of fear of Kamala Harris being elected president of the United States. I think we needed to be demanding better from our politicians across the board. And for me, there is a, you know, I'm going to say this. If you're in Georgia, I urge you to vote for me, because if we don't, we lose things like ballot access. And one of the things that's most important for a third party or independent is to be on the ballot to actually challenge these ideas. And so a vote for me, you know, maybe isn't a vote for today, but what it is, it's a vote to build up a libertarian party that can actually rise up to challenge these two parties, to put these ideas forward to the American people, that allows us to have better choices on our ballot. And so I think the best way to strategically vote is to vote out with no fear, to vote without any reservation, and to vote for the person that most aligns with your policies. Because if we did, we might have different presidents than we've had in the past previously. You know, I urge people to really take a look at our policy platforms. Look up my platform, compare it to Donald Trump's, compare it to Kamala Harris, and pick the one that you think will bring about the most freedom and prosperity for you, your neighbors, and your community. I would wager every day of the week that in a blind taste test, so to speak, people would pick the libertarian platform each and every time. They don't do this because the media manipulates you into thinking you only have two choices. And in many times, they're somewhat correct because we have plurality voting. The other way that you can actually open this process up is demand that the Democrats and Republicans in your state house give you ranked choice voting on your ballot. They have it in Maine. They have it in Alaska. You have it here in New York City for your mayoral primaries. It's a wonderful system that allows for greater consensus for the voter and to be properly represented and not to be further dividing ourselves in some sort of hyper-partisan division that we've continued to see out of the two-party system. But the only way you're going to get ranked choice voting or any other better way to vote is to not vote for the two-party system and tell them why. To say, I didn't vote for you in the last election because I want a better way to vote. If you want me to be marking you second on my ranked choice ballot ever, you better give me ranked choice voting. And this is what will break the system. It will break the back of a duopoly that for too long has taken advantage of the American voting public. They take advantage of your vote in engaging in political pro wrestling, where they're not really fighting each other, but they're putting on a performance for you and me and everyone else to get all excited. And at the end of the day, they get back behind the stage door and they said, we put one over on those voters, and we're bought and paid for by the giant corporate interests that buy and trade our congressmen. That is the truth of this country. That is the truth of our government. It is broken, and the only way to fix it is to no longer submit yourself to the idea that you have to settle for a lesser of two evil. The lesser of two evil is still evil. Vote positively. Vote for who you want to see in the White House, not to prevent someone else from getting there. And if we all did that, if we all dared to do that, we would have a better quality of president, a better quality of a legislature, and a better government that actually serves the needs of the population. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, the resolution reads, among the candidates actively running for president in November, Donald Trump is the best choice. Jane, please open the voting for the final vote. Yes, no, or undecided. I find that while I brought the Tootsie Roll, I can't find it. But that's okay, because I have a Tootsie Roll at home that I can give you guys, since you're both coming to the after party. Tootsie Roll is, of course, of enormous value, gone for a fortune on eBay, but I'm sure you will keep it and treasure it if you win the Tootsie Roll tonight. Again, yes, no, or undecided on the resolution. But while you're voting, I want to announce that on Monday, September 16th, we're not done with a debate about the presidential election. This time, it will be a resolution that reads, among the candidates currently actively voting for president in November, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is the best choice. And that resolution will be defended by the famous David Stockman, who, of course, was a congressman and notoriously Treasury Secretary under Ronald Reagan. Excuse me?
OMB Director.
OMB Director. Thank you. Right. He was OMB Director, wasn't he? You're right. And now, if you read David Stockman's missives, he's pretty strongly libertarian and quite well-informed. He believes that it's useful to vote for Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He will be defending this resolution against the LPVP candidate, Mike Termat. That is of course, Chelsea's running mate. On Monday, October 21st, we're going to get New York Times columnist David Leonhardt to defend the resolution, the stagnation of living standards and soaring economic inequality have become the defining economic trends of American life. That resolution will be opposed by Cato Institute adjunct fellow John Early, who has co-written a book called The Myth of American Inequality. So that will be an economics debate. Art, you're invited to come. It's right up your alley. You probably want to attend. Maybe ask some questions from the floor. That will be Monday, October 21st. In November, we are going to go south of the border, so to speak, and have a debate on the libertarian president, Javier Milei. By November, we will have known who won the election, so we're going to wait a bit, and now we're going to get a little bit interested in what the libertarian president, Javier Milei, is done and has been doing in Argentina. We have two Argentinians who will be taking pro and con on that one. We have a shot, a good shot, at having that debate at Northeastern University in Boston. And you people, as member, as Soho Forum regulars, will, of course, be given first dibs to get tickets there. Part of our mandate has been to go to college campuses. The debate I actually had on socialism that got all those views was at NYU, but then I found because of the crazy lockdowns, it was becoming increasingly difficult to get access to local college campuses, but we do have a connection at Northeastern, and through that connection, we should be able to get Harvard and local universities to come to a pretty large hall to that debate. So we're hoping to have it up there in Boston. If not, we will be having it at the Sheen Center. Jane, where do we stand on the voting? Oh, looks like drum roll, please, and the Tootsie Roll will be thrown at the right party. Okay, now, the resolution the resolution read that we should vote for Donald Trump. The yes votes went from 21.9% to 24.6%. That picked up 2.6 percentage points. So that's the number to beat. The no vote went from 47 to 69. It picked up 21 votes. So the Tootsie Roll goes to the no, the negative vote.
It was rigged.
Occasionally we have a sore loser, but he's a charming guy nonetheless. Art, please come. Please come to our party afterwards, because I think a lot of people would love to talk to you. Guys, it's at 55 Great Jones Street, otherwise known as 3rd Street. It's two blocks uptown. Jane knows where it is. Follow the wheelchair. That'll be me. You'll find it that way. And there are about half the audience, I think, have been there, and they know where it is. Two blocks uptown on Great Jones Street. That's where the wine and all the rest will be there. And that's where Lou Perez, follow him as well, will be doing book signing and sales. So we'll see you up there very shortly. Thank you to both debaters for a great performance.